Technology has certainly shaped beauty. Smartphones, artificial intelligence, and the metaverse are changing how we present ourselves on and offline. But how has beauty shaped technology? Hi, I'm Isabella Rossellini. In the latest episode of This Is Not a Beauty podcast, we'll hear from a Meta executive, a Paralympian, and more. Listen now on your favorite podcast platform.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your Here's a Bell of Music, Music, Criticism. I'm John Caramonica.
I'm Joe Coscarelli.
That's right. We're back. Rage Rap 3.0. Let's all take a deep breath. Because we are about to run through the literal gauntlet. We woke up this morning in a world where the number one album in the country is a Yeats Lifestyle. And if you pay attention to us, if you listen to podcasts over the years, you know about Yeat. You're tapped in. You're dialed in. He is back.
And if you don't know about Yeat, how would you explain such a guy?
I have 45 minutes in front of me to do all that explaining. Yeat is a rapper who has been able to develop a cult popularity, obviously, in a very, very specific sub-niche of hip-hop. However, I have a theory that Yeat's version of Rage Rap, which I think he is the best known and most popular exponent of, I think.
Not counting the sort of forefathers of...
Not counting the forefathers.
Like his Scott or
no,
a Playboy
right,
Cardi.
No, generationally. Like, let's say people who are under 30. To me, Yeat is probably the most actually popular of that generation of artists. And I think represents a bit of a seismic shift for what younger rappers are looking to when they think, hey, I want to grow up and be a rapper. And I think that Yeat's generation... This is my softball theory, has remade dominant hip-hop aesthetics far more than actually the Travis. Like, I think Travis, Thug, Uzi are the things that set the template, but there was still this sense that maybe that was outlier stuff and it was going to kind of come back around. I think that Yeat's generation is like confirmation that it may have almost permanently shifted in that direction.
Meaning rap music is not about rapping.
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
That is what I mean.
It's about world building. It's about the loudest possible beats of all time. It's about mosh pits, yes. Live show experience. It's about mystique and balaclavas.
Yes.
And these are all
expensive
things.
Expensive balaclavas. Yes. Not cheap balaclavas.
And these are all things balaclavas that Yeat traffics in.
Yeah. And also, I think, unlike a lot of these other stars from the generation just above him, who I think of as still relatively conventional celebrities, right? Uzi is a celebrity. Cardi, more or less, is a celebrity.
Travis Scott, definitely
Travis
a celebrity.
100% a celebrity.
Mostly a celebrity.
Yes, and obvious. We'll talk about the EDM stuff also in a little bit. And obviously Future and Thug, very, very clearly celebrities. But Yeat basically was like, I can make these records. And I wish for no one to know what I look like.
That's an interesting granting of agency.
I believe it. You don't believe it?
Well, I guess the question would be, and I want to have this conversation. So Yeat is from a long line of semi-anonymous, extremely popular artists. Artists whose rise is inextricable from the fact that people don't know that much about them.
Yes.
Or don't know what their face looks like. Maybe don't know what race they are.
Yes.
A sort of, you know, The Weeknd being like maybe the pioneer of it in the modern era. But, you know, countless examples since.
And my second theory is that this is very specifically pandemic coded.
Okay.
That's yes. My second theory is that you had like an 18-month stretch where all of a sudden you were free to become incredibly famous without ever having to show anybody anything about yourself IRL. And then by the time everybody came back on the road, Yeat is a star. But I think if there had been no pandemic, those pressures would have been placed on him much earlier, and I don't think his arc would have been nearly the same and nearly as successful.
But I guess my question then, going back to my setup, was, is Yeet semi-anonymous, which he no longer is anymore? He's basically given that up because you have to with time to make more money and to keep the plot line going.
Sort of.
But were the initial choices to remain obscured defensive or artistic? Like, were they like, nobody's going to take this music seriously if they know who I am and what I look like?
He's a very regular guy.
A regular guy of British and Mexican descent from Oregon?
Romanian, I believe.
Romanian. His father is British and Mexican.
Yes, but and his mother's?
According to sources. He doesn't give a lot of straight answers in the rare times that he does do press.
Also, in the moments where you have actually seen what he looks like there's that IG post from like a charity or food bank in Texas where he just kind of like showed up, or in Oregon, I don't remember, but he's like showed up to do charity or give money or donate food. He's just like, as we've said before on the show, Yeet, just a guy.
Just a guy.
Mm-hmm. But it's notable to me that someone who is, in essence, just a guy, albeit a rich one at this point, can make music that is both this popular, this central to the conversation, even if it's the type of music that, like, sort of like classic rap. Like, you're not going to hear it on Hot 97 necessarily, but it is absolutely near the center of conversation as far as where the genre is going. But he's just a guy.
But you're talking about his anonymity as a potential liability for him, whereas I see it as a value add. And in fact, maybe the only reason that this music was able to get this popular. I think if you start just a guy forward, then people maybe take the music less seriously than if they don't know where it's coming from, which I think worked similarly for Abel Tesfaye, The Weeknd. Like, you know, early on, you were like, what kind of madman is coming up with this stuff? And when you're like, oh, it's just this, you know, diminutive Canadian guy, like that sort of like takes away, you know, maybe that takes away something.
You just call The Weeknd small.
But like, or, you know what it makes me think of a lot, Yeet, which, you know, forgive me, but Salem.
Interesting.
You know, couple of white dudes.
Couple guys.
Making 3-6 Mafia music from the depths of the New Orleans swamp.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the selling point is the haze of.
Yeah, sure.
Who the heck is this and where are they coming
from? But here's my philosophy with especially the pandemic era anonymity. Hip hop consistently struggles on an audience level with who is the music for. Is it for insiders or is it for outsiders? Are there ways to make people who are not either growing up around, like frankly growing up in black communities or growing up around hip hop, is there a way for those people to be brought into the genre? And so to have someone who essentially is anonymous and is bringing in a new generation of fans coming from a wide variety of backgrounds, that actually feels extremely in line with where things have been going over the last several years. It feels very post-Rolling Loud. It feels very post-Astroworld. I don't mean the Astroworld tragedy, but just the idea of a huge tent of people who, if you go, does not seem like the kind of crowd that, like, I used to go to Tramps with or SOBs with in the 90s or 2000s. It's a very
8-ball jackets.
Dare I say no 8-ball jackets. No 8-ball jackets, no Pelés, no Al Wissums, none of the above. And so that is actually, like, people have all this agony within the genre of, like, oh, we're losing the center. It's going in all these unexpected directions. But it's like, I think the people who are living in a post-Astro World, post-Rolling Loud reality have no anxiety about it. They're like, no, this is what hip-hop is. What hip-hop is it's high energy. It actually has a lot in common. I've said this about Travis before. It has a lot in common with EDM. It certainly doesn't prioritize rapping or narrative storytelling or really anything that feels connected to a grounded, non-filtered human voice. This is all highly technologized music. And so once you're removing any sense of classicism or humanity from the music, you're obviously going to be able to have an entire new category, not just a fan, but of creator. And Yeet feels optimized for this kind of moment in hip hop.
So we're talking about Yeet as celebrity, as icon, as avatar. What about the music?
Lifestyle.
So he's had this, yes. Yeah, so he's had this kind of strange quick rise since the pandemic. You know, you get Up to Me, which comes out 2021, puts out a string of albums. After that, they all sort of climb on the charts. I think he went from Two Alive was number 6 in 2022. Afterlife was number 4 last year. 2093, the album he put out at the beginning of this year, hits number 2, but is lambasted by the faithful. People felt let down by the new Yeet, which to an untrained ear might sound a lot like the old Yeet. I do love, and I do think it speaks to the worlds that these guys are building, the dedication of these fan bases, that any minor tweak in the way he's like selecting beats or the flows he's using or the lyrics or the vocal mixing, any tweak to the formula is like, it's a new Yeet.
Like, are you sure? I thought it was Dylan going electric. Right. Is that what that was?
Right. And you're sort of like, okay. I'm missing the nuances here, unless you're part of the cult of Yeet. But then we get this album Lifestyle.
But I do want to say, just for the record, sure, I am not a full Yeet cultist, yeah, but even I thought the last album was not as effective as this album.
Yeah, fine. Quality can vary. You can like one project more than the last or whatever, but like the idea that he's doing something radically different musically in between projects strikes me as a little bit far-fetched. And yet here we are at Lifestyle, his second album of the year, his first Billboard chart topper. And it sounds
like 2022 Yeet.
Like, give me that old Yeet.
as they say on Twitter all the time, we are so back. That's how I feel listening to Lifestyle. We are so back. Like when I first was engaging with Yeet content, mm-hmm, in 2021, I guess is what it would have been. Maybe late 2020 or 2021. I feel like it opened up like a bit of a portal where you're just like, everything here is spastic and chaotic and serrated. And it almost feels like buildings collapsing on top of each other, just like one after the next. And that was incredibly exciting. And actually, the kind of radicalism, like even coming after like Whole Lotta Red and Playboi Carti, which is like obviously a touchstone for a lot of this generation, but Whole Lotta Red feels like a Queen album compared to Yeet. Like it literally
disagree.
Oh, come on. It feels like absolutely well considered and constructed.
I think it's the other way around. I think the Carti albums, even years on, still sound surprising and scary and punk, whereas the Yeet albums are like quite
overblown.
Yeah, and elaborate. And I mean, all done via loops and samples and, you know, digital drums, like with only a few pieces. But I think that something about their sameness, something about the like relatively narrow palette doesn't give me the same whiplash that the construction of a Playboi Carti album does.
Okay, I can see that. I don't know that I agree with it, but I can see it.
But we're talking about this sort of throwback sound for him. Like, can we just listen to a little bit of
we played something at the beginning. What do you want to hear?
This is STFU. This is the second track on Lifestyle. This has a Tommy Wright sample in it, which is very Travis.
Sure. Absolutely.
To stick this at the end. But these beats have 3, 4, 5 producers on them, led by Synthetic.
Synthetic doing a bunch of it.
Who says in a recent Fader profile that they created thousands of beats.
Also,
this album? Thousands.
Like
4,800.
And he's got like 20 guys working for him, yes, who all do like maybe or doing beats every day. Yes. And then they all get filtered up. Incredible.
And then he's like, I need more bass in this one. And they send it out to the beat pack sweatshop. And then it
comes
back.
Dare I say the future of podcasting?
Let's just listen to
this. I would love, can I get 20 producers? Can I get 20 people working on
a little tiny section? And then we'll loop it.
I I'm Michael Gold. I'm a political correspondent for the New York Times. My job is to cover the race for president this year. The Times' live coverage is so valuable because we have people on the ground who can give you information as they're experiencing it. And we have a team of reporters and editors sifting through the day's information, giving you real-time updates so that in any given moment, you have a sense of what's happened that day, what's coming still, what it all means. It's so hard in a breaking news situation to sort out what you actually need to know at the Times. You know that we're putting things in the context that helps what you're seeing in the moment make a lot more sense. You're getting fast information, but you know that it's reliable. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you get access to all of our live coverage leading up to the election and on election night itself. You can subscribe at nytimes.com/subscribe.
This reminded me of in the complex story about Yeat. So Yeat hasn't done a lot of press. In the complex story about Yeat from a couple of years ago, there's a part where he talks about his own contributions to the production and his own vocal approach.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he says, which I think is quite funny, is he records his ad-libs first and then writes his raps.
Usually, traditionally, ad-libs are the final thing to be done to a vocal track.
But it is the kind of like, it's the logical endpoint.
Yeah, what if we made the whole song out of ad-lib? What if the whole plane was the black box?
Absolutely. You know? And it's like when you sort of are coming out of Future, Thug, Uzi, people who are exceptional ad-libbers, and often the most memorable part of songs are going to be the ad-libs. It's not surprising that someone who was 15 or 16 when those records started popping would think of the ad-libs as the entry point into a song. I think it's actually quite special.
Yeah, just when we just another little detour into the making of Yeat's music.
Lore.
Yeah, the lore. From this Fader story, Yeat Inc. by Vivian Medithi. There's a section where he's talking about how he tells Synthetic what kind of beats he wants. And then they make a playlist and he asks for things like a beat that sounds like Crystal Castles with crazy drums.
Yeah.
Or quote, a Travis Scott inspired beat, but with lifestyle elements. You know, so like a Travis Scott beat, but make it Yeat.
Right.
Which is, you know, it's incredible. And he says about Synthetic, this guy could pump out any given day 400 beats. I would listen to every single one of them.
But this is also like, we are fully and firmly in the type beat era.
Oh, yeah.
Like we've been for a while, but now the idea, like, I, you know, here, allow me to be old for a minute. Can I just be old for a minute?
I would never stop you.
I thought you were going to say, for just a minute? I'm old enough to remember when you, like, had to go over to your dusty crate of records.
Crate, yeah.
Flick through the piles, pull something up, and say, I hope that there's something on here that's unexpectedly funky.
I hope there's a break.
Exactly. Or a weird sound that I could chop up. Then you put it on the turntable, drop the needle 20 places.
How many beat tapes are in your past, John?
Oh, crap. No, absolutely not. The real question is how much rapping is in my past? That's dark, actually. We'll talk about that on another episode. Maybe that's mailbag episode stuff. So the labor of constructing a single beat, to say nothing of refining, perfecting, honing the sound and style, and then essentially asking someone to rap on it, maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. It's a tremendous amount of labor. We are now in an era where, the type beat era, where you very simply can listen to something, say, I want something that's like that, not to be all Virgil, but 3% different, take the raw elements, tweak it, flip it, make something new, and then it's like a hit for Yeat. That's how things work now. And it's only going to get crazier. And I think I wrote about this kid very briefly in a thing I did recently. That guy on TikTok, Rob TMB.
Who speed recreates.
Speed recreates on FL Studio.
Beats like, that were already speed created.
Yes, exactly. So he'll do like Soulja Boy. He'll do Lil Tecca Records. And he just recreates the beat from scratch in like under 15 seconds. What a special thing. But that's not that radically different from how actual beat making is now.
Especially when you're making 4,800 of them for one album.
Absolutely.
Yes. Does this album, what does this album
does it
say
mean, does
about
it mean anything?
And his career and where it is heading? I'm laughing. I like this music. Don't get me wrong. Like, I think this is an inspired use of the rap toolkit. I really do.
I like it slightly less than the 2021 and 2022 releases, but it's good. It's very much in that, it's in that milieu. Here's the thing. One of the things that comes with anonymity, obscurity, blocking yourself from fame and celebrity, one of the things that means is that you can't do a Sabrina Carpenter remix, right? Mm-hmm. You can't make a video that's doing anything other than catering to your base, right? So what he's done is he's growing his base audience, but I don't think that he's growing it radically, and I don't think that he's reaching out. Who are the guests here? Kodak, obviously, that's a bit of a reach. Summers, who's like kind of in the scene anyway.
Who's basically just another one of these guys.
Is that it?
I think. Lil Durk.
Durk, right.
There is a
tough week to have Durk on a record.
There is some ad libs from Laserdim.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which I think is a...
A nod.
Bit of a torch passing.
Yeah. Sure.
I mean, these guys are passing blunts back and forth, not passing torches generationally.
Or maybe blowtorches. Maybe blowtorches.
Yes.
But to me, the proposition here, like when Yeet goes on tour, you remember there was like a canceled Yeet tour last year or maybe the beginning of this year. And it was like pretty big. Maybe he was going to play the Garden or it was like fairly large.
It's a matter of time.
Yeah. Like it's not that his self-contained universe is small and has no reach. It's actually quite big if you can sell out 10 to 15,000 in seats in various cities. The question is that the new frame of hip hop? Mainstream hip hop? Because the other stuff does seem like it's slipping away a little bit. It's been an interesting year for what we have thought of as hip hop centrism. That does not appear to be as potent as it used to be.
Though we were talking about this off mic, and there is some strains of more down the middle stuff, right? There's the popularity of Boss Man D-Lo.
Yes.
There's the popularity of Glorilla.
Big X the Plug.
These are rappers.
Yes.
Like identifiably rappers.
Rappers who your uncle would recognize.
Yeah, like, oh, this is Southern rap, sure, but it's rap.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, that's, but those things don't feel like, those things feel to me more niche than ever. Mm. Like maybe they get a little bit of burn in the Rap Caviar universe, but it's like, how much Boss Man D-Lo are we hearing on Hot 97 and Power 105? Obviously, it's a New York radio station, and I'm sure you're hearing more down in Atlanta. You're hearing it in Birmingham, Alabama. You're hearing it in Houston and Austin and Dallas. But how much are you really hearing it? Maybe not so much. And I just wonder, is music like this at a certain point going to, like, Boss Man D-Lo can't sell out the Garden. Big X Plug Sing can't sell out the Garden. But you know who can? Travis, who sold out MetLife Stadium recently. Playboi Carti absolutely sell the Garden and Yeet. At some point, I mean, do people who work at streaming and radio and all these other places just be like, this is hip hop now? Like, just it requires some mental leaping.
Because we think of it as alt.
Yes.
We think of it as an alternative to traditional hip hop.
A subset.
A subgenre.
Yeah.
A spinoff. And you're saying, what if it's just the thing?
But I think if we talk about, and this might be an interesting moment to talk a little bit about lineage, when we think
how did we get here?
Right. When we think of where this is coming from, obviously you want to start with Future, Thug. You want to start in Atlanta in the early to mid 2010s. You want to go to Uzi in terms of all the rock star stuff from 2016, 2015. You want to talk about Rolling Loud, and Rolling Loud basically inventing the hip hop festival, but framing it as mosh friendly.
Right.
And it's not
reinventing it from a Rock the Bells style. Right,
exactly. And it's not that someone like, I mean, I'm not remembering this correctly, but I feel like at some point, like, Jadakiss played Rolling Loud, but like, I bet he had a way smaller crowd than Travis or Cardi
or Summers.
Or Summers, yes. Ian. Yeah, smaller crowd than Ian, probably. You know, I'm also reminded of like what happened at Summer Jam this year, where like Method Man was like, this isn't our crowd anymore. And it's like, dog, you have no idea
how much this isn't your crowd.
Yeah, it's way, way worse. It's actually way worse. And so you have a generation of people who are incredibly regionally popular, internet popular, and beloved by the critical elite, I would say, you know. Critics love.
That's interesting. You think of Yeet as beloved by the critical elite? I think it's still...
No, I'm talking about the older generation. I'm talking about the Future mixtape run. I'm
sure.
Talking
about that stuff now.
Yeah,
has
I'm talking
camp.
About Thug yes. pre-Camila Cabello.
Which even...
Crossover song.
It's important to remember that at the time, that stuff was also controversial.
Controversial in hip-hop.
And critically.
I loved it personally.
Of course,
yes.
But don't you think it took some...
It was a generational divide.
Yes.
You were either in or out. But I think... The thing that older critics of my generation, people older than my generation struggle with is everybody. It's like the Yachty thing. It's like, what do you mean you haven't listened to Rakim? What do you mean you haven't listened to Kool Moe Dee? And it's like, dog, it's been 30 years. Why would this person? And if you grow up and the biggest star on your block, on your radio station, on your internet playlist is Young Thug.
Yeah.
All this makes
future
sense.
Future is Yeats Rakim.
Yes.
100%. Plain as day.
Yes.
And that's okay.
I totally agree. But I think what it has created creates Playboi Carti and the Opium Enterprise. It creates Yeat and whatever Yeats. What is Yeat? Lifestyle. Is that his label too?
Lifestyle. If you say so. I do think we need to note here that Yeats' manager... And the owner of his boutique label.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Is
Zach Bia.
Zach Bia.
Zach Bia. Shout out Zach Bia.
Influencer.
Miss you,
Bia. DJ. Friend of.
FOD. Friend of Drake.
And everyone else.
Yeah, sure.
Zach Bia, I think it represents something in this. The fact that Yeat is aligned with Zach Bia means something. It's not quite hip hop in the sense of it doesn't come from within in that way.
Yeah, although Zach Bia has tried it with other folks.
Yes.
He tried it with SSG Kobe. It didn't work. You know, it's like, it's not totally like a 100% cheat code.
No. But I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's coming from an amorphous
online
nightlife party space that's not necessarily what we think of as the minors of working your way up in the rap universe.
Although I do genuinely wonder, does Zach Bia play Yeat in his DJ sets? I actually don't know.
Well, it's interesting when we think about where this is going, both for Yeat and as a genre or subgenre, and the sound is morphing into hyperpop.
Oh, yeah.
I want to talk about these two songs in the middle of the album.
Oh, okay, good.
Gone for a Man and Forever Again. Which are pop songs, right?
Sure.
Or EDM songs.
Yeah, they're definitely songs that, in the sense I said earlier, like you don't have Yeat in his anonymity doing a Sabrina Carpenter sample, but you do, or appearance, but you do have this.
Right.
Which is like, maybe it's the closest he's going to get.
Yeah, or maybe it's a step towards more of that. I mean, Yeat's version of a Sabrina Carpenter song is being on a Drake song.
Yes.
He had the biggest song, IDGAF, from For All the Dogs from last year. That took on a life of its own, in part because of Yeat's presence, I would say. But I do get a little bit of, you know, in 21 Savage, every now and then he'll do like a melodic song.
Yeah. He was a great lover of R&B.
Yeah, he is. But it on a record, you know, you're listening front to back and it's a little jarring and feels like I don't want to say forced, but it feels like a move. He's doing a move to try to get into something. You know, there's like one on I Am Greater Than I Was, the 21 Savage album, Ball Without You, you know, where he's sing-songing basically. And it feels like market testing.
And that's what this feels like to
you. Yeah, like let me just throw this out there. I'm going to tuck it in the middle of a 30-track album. Two little random records. And if they take off with a different audience, then
tells me something.
Yeah, maybe I'm playing Vegas next year instead of Rolling Loud. Maybe I'm in the club for a residency. I don't know. I just think like there's a lot of mileage in Yeat, both because of his mutability and because of who he is and what he likes, that I don't think he has to be constrained by being a rapper, quote unquote.
Do you, well, with that in mind, do you think that we'll ever arrive at a Yeet era that's not masked?
I would say we're almost in it. We're in a semi-masked era. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's representative of the place that he's in, where do I pivot and go full mainstream? Do I try to become Juice WRLD? Or do I burrow deeper into my fantasies about aliens and the future and all of this concept, quote unquote, concept album, world building, whatever it is he's doing? That, and it's a question that I think is being faced by a lot of musicians right now, which is a good, yes. Am I playing only to my base mm-hmm. and going deeper there? Or am I trying to reach new audiences and transcend these bubbles that we've all found ourselves in culturally?
So I think this is a good point in the conversation to talk about Opium, to talk about Ken Carson and Destroy Lonely. Obviously, the two biggest artists signed to Playboi Carti. Playboi Carti is someone who I feel like every 3 months we're like, no, this is when Playboi Carti breaks out.
Yeah, Playboi Carti had his best start of a year ever, did a crazy rollout of 3, 4, 5 songs, a bunch of huge features, was like, I'm here, ready for my album, and then poof, gone.
By design.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Also, another canceled tour. Is that correct?
Yeah, that one was canceled a couple times.
I feel like it was canceled like maybe even like the day before. Like, I feel like I had that on my actual calendar and it was no. So Playboi Carti is, to my ear, probably the most novel stylist of this generation. You know, Whole Lotta Red will obviously go down as like one of the most important albums of the last 10 years. It really, really shaped how a lot of young people understand hip hop.
Well, that's why even when you say this generation, I think of Playboi Carti as now of a previous generation.
Yes.
And we're looking at his children.
Yes. So Playboi Carti has some serious allegations against him. Destroy Lonely also has some allegations against him. So just something to keep that in mind as we're talking. So Destroy Lonely had an album that came out a couple of months ago. It's called Love Lasts Forever. Let's listen to something off of that. Let's listen to Love For You on the Destroy Lonely record. She trying to eat my ring. She trying to... I went to sleep dead, bro. I woke up to rings. I ain't never ever had a friend. I got a black trust in that friend. My man got a big break. I keep a big in my gun. I'm in the air pulling up the major seat. I went to bed and she showing me that. All my money stacking taller than a midget. I smoke a kill. It's Estet Herndon, host of The Run-Up from The New York Times. For over a year, we've been traveling the country.
We're talking to people in Wisconsin today about how they're feeling about the election. We're talking to people in Michigan specifically because it matters so much.
We are in New Hampshire.
Talking to voters about the issues that matter most to them. Listen to The Run-Up wherever you get your podcasts.
My communications person tells me that people actually listen to your podcast. Is this true?
It is. Thank goodness.
To me, of this group of folks that we're talking about today, Destroy Lonely might be the actual rapper in this entire ecosystem. Again, it's not Griselda, but it's like, it's rapping, it's structured, it's got complex multisyllabic rhymes. It's more classic, but there's a tremendous amount of obfuscation in between the words and the final product. Destroy Lonely and Ken Carson, to me, they play an interesting visual role. They aesthetically similar, obviously the Opium aesthetic, Stellata leather and Rick and Heliot Emil and like all kinds of drapey clothes.
Vamp life,
tight or baggy, expensive fabrics. Yeah,
ideally.
Yes, exactly. Even though you do know what they look like, you do see them, they do operate with a certain amount of mystique. And I was talking to somebody else about this recently, but it stuck with me and it made me think hard about why that mystique exists. Have you seen the Nardwar with the two of them?
I have not.
There's a Nardwar with the two of them.
I can imagine.
And they are both so weird and giggly and nerdy and strange.
This is what I meant about
I know.
The Weeknd and Yeet.
Yeah.
You know? But these like, are guys, the I think it is underrated how much guys who sit in their room and make music, no matter how cool and tough they sound on these records. They're just guys sitting in their room making music.
So it's quite striking when you watch the Nardwuar that they're literally just they're internet bros, you know, they're internet kids, and they don't seem, forgive me, they're not like swag. They're not swag. They're not cool, you know, sorry, forgive me. And that's quite striking. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, yet they have crafted this entire mystique. And to go back to your Yeet question, is that offense or defense? And in this case, it does seem, at least in some capacity, to be a bit of defense. I mostly like Destroy Lonely musically. I think Ken Carson's pretty good. The Ken Carson X album from 2 years ago, mm-hmm. probably his best album mm-hmm. to me. There was an album last year that also was pretty good.
A Great Chaos.
Yeah, that was last year's album. But the fact that here is a set of guys who also are they're very much in the mold. They're trafficking in mystique, quasi-anonymity or quasi-obfuscation, making highly, highly filtered music that to a person of my generation would sound hellacious.
Mm-hmm. Like noise.
Yes, but it is noise. And again, I mean, Rage Rap 3.0. Do you feel like the opium stuff, where do you think it sits in relationship to Yeet?
I think it's of a piece, certainly. I think it is, as you've said, the default mode. I think if you poll college kids
yeah.
about what kind of rap they're listening to, it starts with
Navy and Blue. Opium.
No, it's not Navy Blue. Nobody's listening to Navy Blue.
Sorry.
Numbers don't lie. I think this is it's an alternative mainstream, and it is yeah. but it might just be the mainstream. And you're right about that. And I think there isn't anything after this. I mean, it's interesting that we
Navy
see
Blue
this.
Is the common of this generation. Take that for what you will. This like you can. That's an open-ended statement. He's the common of this generation. Wow. That's all I'm saying.
Wow. Just so he's going to be in Microsoft commercials in 20 years?
Not no. just leaving that there.
Yeah, I think this stuff is here to stay, but I have been interested in how little saturation it has outside of
That's what I'm saying. Everybody is it else. Here to stay in the sense that the tent remains tented?
Mm. Definitely.
It might get bigger, but it remains tented. Is it here to stay in that way? Nick is here engineering with us today, talking about emo revival.
Yep.
Tented, mm-hmm. right? It's mm-hmm. It's bigger.
A huge tent.
Huge yeah. tent, but still a tent.
Yeah.
Is this tented? Because one of the tensions of hip hop in the 90s and 2000s, especially, is how does it interact with the pop mainstream? How does it interact with white audiences, etc.? This seems to be an offshoot that's like, actually, we're totally fine not being in discourse with anybody who's not already in the building.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that is the future of the genre? That it's actually far more cloistered than we have had to reckon with over the years?
I do think so. And I think it's in part because younger artists are taking the success of this stuff as a license to be even stranger and
right.
even and louder yes. and even mm-hmm. weirder.
Right. I think. You get popular very fast. You get attention really fast. You double, triple down on this thing.
And do I see any of these people transcending that and wanting to leave the tent and choosing an old school mainstream audience versus sold out shows in the places that only radio play was supposed to get you? You know, if you have everything that comes with mainstream stardom, but you don't have to sacrifice.
Yeah.
And yet you have someone like Yeet on his last two albums, as he's gotten more and more popular and gotten looks from bigger and bigger people, you do feel him succumbing to some of that temptation of let me try it. Let me see what it looks like to sit courtside at a game next to, you know.
Was it like a Trailblazers game? Does that even count?
He's from Oregon.
But I'm just saying, does that even count?
Yeah, but I mean, it feels like a warm up towards mainstream spaces. And when we think about the
Didn't
next
you sit
generation,
courtside at a Trailblazers game not that long ago, it's pretty like if anybody wants us to sit courtside,
yeah, yeah.
let us know.
Yeah, I'm
we'll
down.
Go. What sport will we be willing to sit courtside at?
Well, how many sports have courts?
What, like soccer? Would we do like a local soccer game?
You don't call it court.
Okay, fine. But I'm just saying, like obviously, like WNBA has like that. We've missed that. Yeah. That's off. Mm-hmm. That's off and running. Mm-hmm. What's next? Mm-hmm.
The next it's basketball season.
No. But I'm saying, what's next for like, what's the sport that we could get in early and sit courtside?
Oh, okay. Pickleball.
If you're doing a sport,
cornhole. You ever watch cornhole on ESPN 7?
I do, actually. Yeah, we will happily come out to the cornhole. We'll commentate.
We'll throw the first pitch.
If you're involved in a cornhole league, tap in with us. Let us know.
Yeah. Okay, so you have this new generation, Xavier Sobeis, Osama-san, Netspend.
Tu Hollis. We said the words Tu Hollis. We've been holding back.
First time?
First time. All
right, we'll get there. LaserDim 700.
Yep.
Is there a breakout among this bunch?
Yeah. So, okay.
And who is it and why?
Okay. So I have a couple thoughts on this. Obviously, race plays a factor in this because obviously Netspend is like the breakout star because he's white. He's in fashion. You know,
Bieber Cobain.
Yes. Ayo. Is that really what they call it?
That's what we're calling him.
Okay, yeah. Great. Dark. Extremely dark. You know, already like posed for a photo with Anna Wintour at Paris Fashion Week. Like they're working that angle. But like
as a lull.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. Does it really matter? Mm. Like, it won't be a lull this time next year.
Like Kai Cenat with Adam Silver.
No, that was an actual lull. No. But I mean, 12 months from now, Netspend's going to be walking in fashion shows. Right.
Alongside his pal, Tu Hollis.
Well, so this is the thing. Like, you think of, like, the Lil Peep arc. That's what was going to happen for Lil Peep. Does it happen faster for white artists than it does for black artists? Like, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Netspend, I almost worry he's been pulled into that direction too fast. And the music isn't totally keeping up with the level of notoriety. Already the subject of an ID magazine, huge feature by secondary quotes by yours truly, by our friend Kieran. Like, it's moving very, very fast.
Here's what I'll say. I think F Swag is maybe his best song. I think sanding it down to fit something more resembling traditional popular music has been good for him. And I think if he doesn't take it too far, I think there is a professionalization that can happen to his music that can turn it into something that is both weird, you know, rhyming Bjork and Newark,
sure,
one of the best bars of the year.
Yeah, close enough.
Without sacrificing the things that make him exciting and special. I think it's possible.
I also think he's like authentically a good artist. Like, I think he's authentically talented. I'm really intrigued to see the pressure to not screw it up is as strong, if not stronger, as the pressure to make it great. And that's, I'm a little worried about the tug of war between those two things, but that's what I think is happening now.
I do think there are some label woes in the background also.
Also, I should get my original F Swag t-shirt from the early ASAP era. Yes. I got to go get that out of storage.
Yes. Tu Hollis.
Yeah. So Tu Hollis, first of all, is a son, not the son, but a son of a well-known New York
Times style. Yes. In the brain. Style in How the many brain. Sons are there? Is it a son or the son?
And so Tu Hollis's mother is a well-known industry publicist who we've all known and worked for.
A long time colleague.
Worked with and known for a long time. My sense is that Tu Hollis has kind of tried to not leverage that to the extent that you can't leverage the fact that you were born into some kind of
a music business family.
Yeah, music business family. Mother is not his publicist, not his manager. You know, like, I think doing it kind of, he's trying to do it separately. I don't know. I haven't talked. I really try not to talk to anybody about it because I just kind of want to experience it as it's being experienced out in the world. I think that's important.
Though I do find it interesting that out in the world, the conversation about Tu Hollis is always, always, always immediately followed by, I heard his mom was Skrillex's manager. Which
it's not exactly correct.
Which is a funny twist on things. It's like, you know, but she does do publicity for major artists from The Weeknd to Daft Punk.
Yeah.
And many more.
Sure. And, you know, we talk about cultural nepotism, nepo babies and stuff like that. Like, people think of it in a very literal sense of like a famous person is your parent. But there's also just the inheritance of growing up around cultural sophisticates and like learning things at a very young age.
Yes. Shout out to Claro.
Is Claro in
there? You don't remember these conversations around the rise of Claro?
I
I just accept that. I just accept Clara for who she is.
Yes, thanks. Me too. Yeah.
So all of that said, some of the most astonishing videos that I've seen on TikTok this year have been crowd videos during Two Hollis's opening set on the Ken Carson tour.
Yeah. So Two Hollis is the Sabrina Carpenter Chapel Roan of Olivia 3.0.
Yes. Olivia and Taylor. Yes. So Two Hollis playing in front of a curtain, like no set, just like literally in like the 18 inches between the curtain and the lip of the stage, just running side by side, doing his weird leg kick, which seems to be like well made for like heavy boots. He seems to wear a lot of heavy boots.
Yeah, like lanky guy, big boots.
Yeah, lanky guy, exactly. Crowds absolutely going bonkerific.
To be clear, is not normal for an opening act.
No. No.
On any tour.
I'm a little scared to see what the Kim Carson crowds look like. They probably didn't look that turned. So Two Hollis has maybe three or four legitimately big songs. Maybe we should listen to Jeans, which is like the one, I think, that has people losing their minds. I'm the only choice to God's peace. Love me, you make it far too easy. I see, mm-hmm. Put your body on my jeans. Put your body on my jeans. Double C's, double cheats. Double choice within me. Double kiss in a dream. Double checks on my sleeve, yeah. Double checks on my jeans, yeah. Double checks when I leave you, I say I'm wrong. To your point about the hyper-pop, rage rap intersection, this does feel like a clear post-hyper-pop, hyper-pop 3.0 or whatever. It wouldn't have sounded that crazy in the actual golden era, like the 1.0 Glaive era. It wouldn't have sounded that crazy, but the low end is so intense. Like the stuff that hyper-pop kind of like stripped away and was like, we're not worried about the bass. We're not worried about the low end here so clearly comes up from the opium world and so on and so forth. And the intersection of those two things with a fashion-forward, photogenic, well-culturally connected, young, white star, that could do real damage in 2025.
Is this rap music? Like, if you're saying that whatever Yeet is doing is now rap music, which you're not quite saying, but you're offering the possibility.
It is.
Then you believe Two Hollis to be a part of that. You're really thinking about it.
I am really thinking about it. I don't want to be in that. Christ, you're putting me in like the categorization.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you don't have to. I mean, it's your job, but. I'd say he's not rapping.
I'm tilting no. No. I would say he is rapping, but I'm not sure it's rap music.
See, I think that the beats are obviously derivative of hip hop, but he's not rapping.
That's interesting. I think that the beats are derivative of hip hop, although they're more filtered through the hyper pop lens. I think that the vocals are derivative of rapping, even if they're not purely classic rapping. They're derivative of this, all the stuff we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow it doesn't quite add up to what I think about, even in the space we're talking about of rage rap. It doesn't add up. It feels like it's like a satellite. This is a satellite sound.
Well, it does have fewer of the signifiers that, say, a Yeet does, both in his lyrics and the way he presents himself.
Yeah.
It's slightly more unique than X-Watch, X-LV, whatever.
It also, it feels like the new wave, like the new wave as new wave was to rock music. Like it feels like the new wave spinoff of whatever this is, where it's like close, shares antecedents, but explicitly, and to our point about are this generation of rappers seeking to stay in their tent, this seems explicitly designed to leave the tent. If it started there, it's designed to leave it.
I agree. And I think on the flip side is someone like Glazerdim, who it's really hard to imagine doing anything other than just like dumping it onto SoundCloud. Mm-hmm. And I think that doesn't mean it can't be extremely popular, as we've covered, but it doesn't seem like it's aspiring to something more normal. I'm using normal in a glib way, but it, like, I think the the upset, the chaos of it, the rawness.
Yes.
Feel inextricable in a way that it doesn't necessarily. Like, I do think there is polishing to be done with a Nets bend or a Two Hollis, as we've seen with Yeet, that I, you know, and maybe that's because Laserdim comes from like a slightly more of a gangster rap background. Like, that's thrown in the mix in a way that it's not for these other guys. We talked about the role race plays in this, but this is much more pure Atlanta.
And it's not that melodic. Like, the, right. It doesn't really
with
have
a,
like
with if, a little less melody as well.
We've thought of Atlanta through the 2010s as being the kind of A plus avatars of bringing melodic lines and weaving them in to outside of Drake, like weaving them into like straightforward hip hop. And the current, whether it's Laserdim or like a Baby Kia or somebody like
you're
that,
right. It's drill
it's,
punk.
It's literally the exact opposite. It's like, how do we run away from that stuff?
Yes.
You know, both of those like very, very sharp, jagged lines, very punchy in the rapping. Obviously, subject matter very much in keeping with a long legacy of subject matter, but the actual potency does not come from the unexpected intersection of tough talking subject matter and unusual technologically assisted melody. It's basically just like, I mean, yeah, it is drill adjacent in philosophy.
I'm in your face.
Yes.
Basically.
Should we go out with a Laserdim song?
Yeah, let's play. We'll play the big one from the last, you know, half of the year, Tony Dim.
That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/popcast. The Signal Award winning popcast.
Gold medal?
Gold medal?
Gold medalist with Questlove?
Heavy on my neck? How can I keep my neck up with this gold medal hanging around it? It's unfathomable. Anyway, if you voted for the listener's choice, win a win. But
yeah, where are
where
listeners?
Were y'all?
Not
where
choosing.
Were y'all? Where were y'all? Like, honestly, the Discord, please stand up next time we need voted for.
We didn't do a lot of door knocking.
I didn't do a lot of, no, we were not. That's true.
We didn't mobilize.
We didn't text. I didn't text 10 times a day. But anyway, shout out to the Signal Awards for this heavy, heavy gold medal, which I wear around my neck. In the room, Nick Pittman is here. At home, Pedro is out of Met Separate Media. We will be back next week.
Never did that shit while you lied. The latest 3 sticks on robbing ain't highs. Took out my face, put that climb as disguise. Come to your hood, do a show, then I slide. If we stay longer, we start on the ride. You're licking my hood, you're a bonus prize. Told him I fought when he ain't know me, I lied. I'm sneaky as flow, bitch, I want you to try. Kid a hoe out of what she thought she was slime. The gang in the backseat on passenger slime. Fine shit, wanna drive us around. Kid the back door, tell you open her wide. And a rail on the top, put a scope on the side. Hit at his top, hit at his wiggly. Playing with a little fat, this shit get wicked.